Representative Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Courtney, State Representative District 33. The testimony that I prepared for you is in layperson's language, and it's in somewhat shorthand fashion, and maybe I'm reacting to having dealt with this subject for months during the interim, but usually the documents that deal on the subject are so heavy and so intricate that it's important for at least my type of person to reduce them to layperson's language, if no other reason for my own understanding. So I hope that I haven't insulted anyone's intelligence for writing it in this fashion. Representative Lombard, Representative Springer will probably remember the fact that there was a day, I don't remember the day, in the House Judiciary Committee in 1981 in which we had some bills which touched on the mental state or the insanity state, if you will, of the defendant. And we decided at that time, rather than try to recreate the wheel, if that need be, in the insanity plea, that we would go into the interim and look at the whole area and find out whether or not we needed to make any changes at all. At that time, Representative Tom Mason was heading up the Judiciary Committee, and he called me after the session ended and asked if I would head up the interim committee study. And so we got underway, and I well remember the first day of the hearing, public hearing on the insanity plea, because we had defense attorney against defense attorney, seemingly prosecutor against prosecutor, and psychiatrist against psychiatrist. And I came away with the impression that really it was just too difficult a subject to even mess with, because I think at the time the deal idea was maybe we should try to abolish insanity plea. Subsequently, we were able to put together a group of people who represented prosecutors, judges, psychiatrists, the PSRB, the Attorney General's Office, defense attorneys, and through several public hearings, came up with some ideas which the interim committee were willing to put in a pre-session, in a bill 2075, and have it pre-session filed. Now, I want to be sure to note for the members of the committee here that no one should assume that because you have a bill in front of you, House Bill 2075, that every member of that interim committee necessarily agrees with what's in that bill. What was agreed to is that the ideas that were encompassed there should be put before the House Judiciary Committee in the 1983 session. That brings me to this piece of legislation, House Bill 2075. And personally, Representative Myers, I want it to be said, as far as I'm concerned, Oregon has a very good system. And that's to your credit, Lombard's credit, Representative Lombard's credit, Representative Ruthert's credit, because you were some of the people who played a big role in that, as well as to an individual in the audience who, if he's not the foremost person in insanity plea, he's got to be up there with him, and that's Jeff Rogers. I'm simply trying through this bill to make a very good system better. Now, under the present law, if a person commits a crime and they want to use the insanity plea, it's considered an affirmative defense in Oregon. They allege, I have a mental disease or defect, and therefore I'm not responsible for what I did because, one, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong, or, and the word or should be there, I couldn't get myself to follow the law. Now, that's my interpretation of the way the law is right now when you've got a situation where a person commits a crime and says, I got a disease, a mental disease or defect, because. 1981 House Judiciary Committee felt that there were problems, some of the members felt, with the insanity plea here in Oregon, mainly because of the phrase, not responsible. Some believed, members of the committee, that it put jurors in what would appear to them to be a contradictory position of saying that someone did not commit a crime or was not responsible for it, regardless of how obvious it was that they did commit the crime and regardless of how horrible the crime was. And what would a juror be tempted to do under the situation? And these are my words, Mr. Chair, not necessarily the words of the interim committee or the members of the committee who approved putting this into bill form. Exactly what was done in the Moore case. Ignore the mental disease or defect evidence and find the person guilty of the crime as charged. Now, the bottom line in the Moore case is, people might say, I could care less. The individual's been locked up for life. I don't care whether he's at OSP or the Oregon State Hospital. But it's interesting to note that one of the members who helped me work on this bill, and who was a member of the task force, was Darrell Penn. He's in the audience today. He was the Marion County Deputy DA who prosecuted successfully the Moore case in the sense of fighting off the insanity plea and getting a conviction. I won't speak for Dale, but I think it's somewhat accepted across the land that there was quite a bit of psychiatric evidence that he was nuttier than a fruitcake. Now, such situations put jurors in an impossible situation and make Oregon's insanity plea a myth. That is, everybody knows the person's not even a fruitcake, but because of the nature of the crime, how horrible it is, a juror is simply going to say, I'm not going to come down with a verdict that says he or she is not responsible. There was also another reason that the not responsible plea was seen as flawed. Now, this is fascinating to me because at the time I started this study, I didn't know this. During public hearings before the interim committee, PSRB executive director and mental health division staff testified that the not responsible, often interpreted by the defendant as meaning not guilty, finding served as an inadvertent deterrent to treating a mental disease to defect the defendant. The defendant would have the attitude, I don't need help because the court said I'm not responsible, i.e. guilty, for what happened. That didn't come from me. That came from, if you will, those who deal in this area every day. I found that surprising. But they said what happens is they go to treat these people at the Oregon State Hospital after they're found they have a mental disease or defect, but because the word's not responsible in there, sometimes anyway, they came up against this reaction, hey, court said I'm not responsible, I'm not guilty. And it was a deterrent. I realize we're just talking about words here, but it was very much a factor as to why we got into this. So what was the solution? Well, House Bill 2075 does the following. A person could not use mental disease or defect as a defense. Now, you hear this all the time, that Idaho abolished the defense, the insanity plea, et cetera, et cetera. Now, having said that, I want to back up, because I think I must rush in here quickly and tell you that while we say that you no longer can use it as a defense, that does not preclude a person from showing having any evidence of mental disease or defect, which would be admissible when such is an element of the crime to show mens rea. Now, that was one of the stumbling blocks initially and why Judge Wally Carson said to us when we started out, you can't touch this thing because you cannot abolish or prohibit a defendant from coming in and showing, look, I did not have the mental element necessary in this crime because I am mentally diseased. You can't stop that kind of evidence from coming in. And I believe that all the bills before you, the Attorney General's bill, the DA's bill, as well as this bill, allow that evidence to come in, and I believe constitutionally you would have to. And by the way, Idaho does the same thing. So I think it should be said for the record, in all honesty to the public, because the public in certain states, they get this, oh, we don't have the insanity plea anymore, and then all of a sudden find out that evidence is coming in, the person says, I couldn't have shot that person or intended to shoot that person because I thought the person was a tree. And they're going to bring in evidence to show they mentally couldn't have done it. And you can't stop that evidence from coming in. So I want to make it clear that that kind of evidence can still come in when it's part of the crime, an element is that you had to have the intent to do what you did. Now, after a defendant has pled or been found guilty, the defendant or the state may request a hearing and sentencing on the basis that the defendant has a mental disease. So in effect, we say you can't use it as a defense, but if you're found guilty or you plead guilty under this version, then here comes a hearing which may be requested either by the defendant or by the state to decide whether you have a mental disease or defect. And therefore, when you're sentenced, you're sentenced instead of OSP, OSCI, the Oregon State Hospital. So if you will, and I'm being overly simplistic, the first time you see this defense or this type of thing is at the sentencing stage. And that's in sections 6 and 10 of our bill. Interestingly, we received testimony from mental health that some individuals, after being successfully treated for mental disease, were still considered dangerous. Yet by law, said persons had to be discharged by PSRB. Now, that was another thing that got us into the interim. But at the time, we didn't know what we were doing, in my opinion. We felt that in those real horrible crimes, that rather than allow an individual simply be discharged by PSRB because their mental disease and defect had been cured, they still should have to serve the remainder of their sentence. Well, one of the officials of the Mental Health Division made the statement to us, Dr. Zukow, and I don't quite understand this, to be very frank with you, that there were those times when he felt that you could say the disease or defect was gone, but they still were a danger. Therefore, he did not find it that objectionable to say that that person still had to stay within the system. Now, in our original draft of the bill, House Bill 2075, what we said then is, instead of discharging them, you assign them to the Corrections Division, and you make them subject to the Corrections Division and the parole board standards in the matrix. Now, that's what House Bill, as it originally was put together, does in Sections 3, 13, 14, 50. Now, the crimes, there were certain crimes that we want designated as being particularly horrible in order for this kind of situation to take place. Not all crimes. And the crimes are listed in Section 3, murder, aggravated murder, first-degree manslaughter, first- or second-degree assault, first-degree arson, kidnapping, robbery, any first-degree felony, sexual offense, rape, sodomy, sexual penetration with a foreign object, sexual abuse, or an attempt to commit any of these crimes. So if you committed one of those crimes, and you were found to have a mental disease or defect, you went to Oregon State Hospital, they treated you, they got rid of the mental disease and defect, you would not be discharged necessarily, you would be required to finish out the remainder of your sentence with the Corrections Division at one of their facilities or on a parole board standard. Now, this brings me to the amendment. As you know, Mr. Speaker, you and I met with the executive director of the PSRB as well as the chair of the board in December to go over this. The amendment before you would amend that part of House Bill 2075, which would say that the person, after having committed this crime and being cured, was assigned to the Corrections Division, and no longer would they be transferred to the Corrections Division, they would remain under PSRB jurisdiction. And this idea came from PSRB officials. I think it's a very, very good approach to our system. Therefore, even though PSRB finds that the person, mental disease defect, has been cured, they no longer have to discharge them, which is now the law. They can maintain them and with their system, under their jurisdiction, for the remainder of their sentence. Now, that may mean, gentlemen, that they could put them on a conditional release program. But it's my understanding that conditional release under PSRB is much more tightly scrutinized and supervised than it is under the Parole Board and Corrections Division standards. So that is what this new amendment to this bill does. And PSRB, is my understanding, since the idea basically came from them, totally support the amendment. Once again, I must be very careful here because PSRB at this stage of the game is taking very much of a hands-off attitude. And I don't want to imply necessarily they support this bill in its totality. Finally, the last change that we made, and I'll just smile as I tell it to you because the chair of the interim task force really had to go out on a limb on this one. We changed the definition of what we mean by mental disease or defect. As the law is now written, it means lacked substantial capacity to either appreciate the criminality of the conduct or to conform the conduct to the requirements of the law. That is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about a layperson's interpretation of that. We changed that. We changed that in this bill by doing the following things, just so you. On the last line of the bill, page 13, House Bill 2075, section 21, it repeals ORS 161.295. In effect, it repeals that definition. And then if we go back in the bill to page 3, top of the page, line 1, and then if you come down to page 17, lack capacity to appreciate the criminality of the conduct. So we eliminated the word lack substantial, we eliminated the word substantial, and we eliminated the words or conform the conduct to the requirements of the law. So now, and in fact, it's much more difficult to qualify for a mental disease or defect, whereas before you had to show you lack substantial capacity to either appreciate the criminality of the conduct or to conform the conduct to the requirements of the law. Now it's simply you lack capacity to appreciate the criminality of the conduct. And that was done, to be very frank with you, in deference to the Attorney General. That is why that definition is in House Bill 2075. So those are the three things that House Bill 2075 does in remodeling, if you will, the existing system, which, if my phone calls are correct, is one of the foremost in the nation. I received calls also from NBC saying, it's ironic, we got into this thing because of Hinckley, and many of the states we talk to say, you ought to go see what Oregon's doing. We're interested in what Oregon's doing. So at least from a perception, a national perception standpoint, Mr. Myers and Mr. Lombard, and I wish Mr. Rutherford here, you ought to feel pretty good. Because whatever you did either in 77 or 75 with PSRB is now being studied very closely by many other states. And I really mean when I say, all I'm trying to do here, I think the task force is trying to do, is improve upon a very excellent system. I'm at your disposal, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Courtney. It occurs to me it might be more efficient if we were to hold off any questions, if there are any right now. Let's go through all three bills, and maybe we can get the principal proponents of all three at the table, and we can see if there are questions that relate to more than one bill, and we'll have them all there to deal with. Thank you, Representative Courtney. Very, as usual, a very excellent presentation.
Let's take 2269 or 2892, I don't care. All right, that's fine.
Dave, if you want to come ahead, or Trevor, you want to work that out?
Well, the district.
I just have them listed numerically right now on the calendar, so you.
The District Attorneys Association has sponsored an amendment essentially to the framework that has already been started by the interim committee. And the committee's bill, 2075, has dealt with some issues. They've heard a lot of detailed testimony concerning the problems in the defense itself. Representative Courtney talked about these problems of definition. What is substantial capacity? We've heard psychiatrists before the panel that have said that even though I have testified in murder cases, even though I am considered an expert in criminal law and forensic psychiatry, I do not know what these terms mean. And that is one of the problems in dealing with a mental disease case. In the Moore case, Representative Courtney brought that up. I don't think that that was a situation where the jury disregarded the law. I think that was a situation where the jury dealt with the law and knew the law. And many people these days think that the insanity defense just deals with the issue, does this person have a mental disease? That is one prong of three tests that the defendant must prove. He must also prove it's a result, a causation factor, and then get into the substantial capacity issue. In that case, we went at it as a lawyer, as a defense attorney, really, and said, this is what the law is. Have they proved it? So, really, the Moore case stands as an example of some of the problems in the defense, some of the real problems of trying to tie down what substantial capacity means, what causation is, and all of these things. The ODAA, after working in conjunction with the interim committee and the 2075 being proposed, we went over that at great length, and we saw several problems. Some of those problems came up because of cases decided by the Supreme Court after the interim committee drafted this bill. One of the problems came up after we had consulted with Idaho, some prosecutors in Idaho, to determine how is their bill proceeding and how is it working. That brings us to the key amendments we have, and I prepared a chart. I've written a letter to the chairman and just tried to go over in brief detail about some of the changes and contrasting the three bills. At the end of that letter is a chart where I've tried to highlight for you in abbreviated language the present law, 2075, the ODAA amendments, and the Department of Justice bill. And hopefully that will help you in contrasting those four approaches that are before you. But the ODAA basically in the amendments highlighted some problems. First of all, State versus Wedge is a case that came up by the Supreme Court. The same type of thinking was utilized by the Supreme Court in overturning the death penalty and talking about the judge performing a function that usurps the fact finder's role, taking the jury's function over in a case. We feel that when there is no definition, the way there is none in the 2075, there is a definition for disposition mental disease or defect, which is a decision by the judge after a guilty plea. He will decide at that time, does this defendant lack capacity to appreciate, as Representative Courtney explained to you. However, before you get to that, the jury is also making a decision about mental disease or defect. We're afraid that if they are not distinguished and defined and shown to the court, at least, that they are two distinct standards, not mutually exclusive at all, that will be overturned by the Supreme Court in the same type of analysis they use in death penalty cases in State versus Wedge, which was a gun penalty case. That's one problem. So you see some definitions there. Another problem is, after talking with Idaho, we have found that there is severe concern there that there will be a movement away from utilizing the defense by defense attorneys and moving the same arguments and the same type of analysis over into this area of partial responsibility, or under these three bills, the idea of whether or not the state has proved mens rea. In a murder case, has the state proved that this defendant intentionally tried to kill someone? You can utilize without definitions. It does not prevent the defense from taking the same type of argument and coming in and saying, yes, we're going to call it something different now, but there is no mens rea. That's a problem. The other problem is if you do transfer the focus to mens rea, there is a substantial likelihood that people may be found not guilty. And by definition, they may be the most dangerous people in the world because they do feel like they are squeezing grapes when they're strangling someone, or they feel like they're shooting at a tree when they're shooting at people. And you don't want that person to walk out of the courtroom. In dealing with other district attorneys, it was felt that we needed some type of safety net proposal to prevent that person from walking out of the courtroom, and that civil commitment wasn't that safety net. And that was somewhat corroborated by Idaho. So you see an amendment dealing with safety net procedures. Those are the two big things in the amendments that we propose. And basically, it's the interim committee bill with those big ideas. However, after our proposal was made, the Department of Justice has proposed a third alternative. And after scrutinizing that proposal, we feel that it takes the good things and the intent of the interim committee and some of the safeguards that we've tried to propose in our amendments and incorporated them in one bill in a clear and a concise method. And it is a more simple, it's a simple bill to implement. And I think in criminal law, that's one thing that you have to be concerned about, keeping it simple, because the more framework and structure that you set into a bill, the more difficult it is to place into practice and to utilize as a prosecutor or as a defense attorney in the criminal justice system. Because of that, we are supporting the Department of Justice bill as the primary bill. If, however, the legislature determines that there is not, that bill will not be passed, we are suggesting if the interim committee bill is passed that the legislature consider those amendments that we've written into our bill. That's basically our position.
Okay, thank you. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record.
Excuse me, would you put your name on the record, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Dale Penn, and I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. Dave Frommeyer, Attorney General, representing the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. Chairman, members of the committee, as some of you know, my interest in the subject dates from approximately the mid-1970s when, together with Jeff Rogers, who is in this room, and Justice Carson and numerous others, I was appointed by the then Speaker of the House to examine the serious problems affecting the psychiatric security unit of the state hospital because of the enormous numbers of new persons admitted by reason of insanity to the secure custody of that hospital. In the course of that detailed examination, I became extremely interested in and concerned about the laxness of the defense of criminal insanity in the state of Oregon, at least insofar as it appeared to be quite literally out of control in our criminal justice system. Since that time, I've tried to refine my knowledge, and my conclusions, basically, Mr. Chairman and committee members, are these: that the insanity defense is needlessly expensive, it's often scientifically unsound, it's unevenly administered, sometimes presents dangers to the public, and is indeed increasingly a threat to the credibility of the criminal justice system itself. I come here today not to quarrel with the Psychiatric Security Review Board or its creation, because I do believe, as previous witnesses have testified, that it is a very desirable refinement in the administration of any system which includes the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. So my quarrel does not lie with the board, it does not lie with Mr. Rogers. However, I respectfully disagree with those who believe that in other respects our system of the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity is exemplary. I believe that it is not. In fact, I believe it's a serious problem in our criminal justice system, and I'd like to take just a few moments to highlight the reasons why I believe that to be true. In the first place, simply the startling statistic that comparing Oregon to New York, which is a state that has a very similar defense and similar wording, one finds the American Journal of Psychiatry giving us evidence that in Oregon, the defense is successfully used 9 times as often per capita as in the state of New York. The figures demonstrating that are contained in my prepared testimony. They will show you that in 1976 to 78, there were more persons in absolute numbers in the state of Oregon who successfully were found not guilty by reason of insanity on an insanity defense than there were in the state of New York, a state which has about 8 or 9 times our population. That isn't a matter of indifference as long as the person is incarcerated someplace, because the next thing that ought to disturb the committee is that it costs 3 times as much to the public for a person to be in a secure psychiatric ward as it does to be incarcerated. a rate of nearly $3,000 a month for the persons who are currently in a state mental hospital. But that isn't even the total problem with the insanity defense. Dr. Trelevin, who's the administrator of the Mental Health Division and well-known to members of this committee, and I believe a highly credible forensic psychiatrist himself, has written to the department that in the clinical judgment of the psychiatrists at the state hospital, between 30 to 40% of the individuals incarcerated, after a finding of not responsible due to mental disease or defect, are in fact not appropriate for treatment in a state mental hospital. And yet these persons continue to be dangerous to the public. I know of no state in the union in which there is a higher per capita successful use of the not guilty by reason of insanity defense than in the state of Oregon. And look though we might, I've found no one to contradict that particular stark feature of Oregon's criminal justice system. Some of our objections have been identified already, Mr. Chairman, and I'll simply highlight them, therefore, because they're familiar to the committee, but I think they bear repetition. The present system is inaccurate and confusing in telling the public, and the criminal defendant for that matter, that he or she is not responsible. The present model penal code test, which Oregon uses, is capable of wild manipulation by defense attorneys, by psychiatrists on both sides, by prosecutors perhaps. It is nowhere defined in the law, nor is it defined in the rules of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. That creates the natural groundwork for the battle of experts, which has so, I think, discredited both law and the mental health provision professions in the aftermath of the Hinckley test. The test is hopelessly subjective because of the use of the term substantial, which Representative Courtney, I think, very adequately demonstrated. The test is at odds with our notion of commonly understood concepts of personal responsibility. The insanity defense is a significant and unnecessary drain on public resources. Even in the common property misdemeanor where an insanity defense might be urged, I'm told by prosecutors in the field that the defense costs for the prosecution and prosecution costs for expert testimony can exceed $1,500 for that single expert witness or set of expert witnesses alone. In a complicated homicide case, that figure could easily exceed $10,000 per side, usually at public expense in the case of indigency. And of course, beyond that, there are the costs of treatment for those 30 to 40% of the people whom the psychiatrists themselves believe are inappropriate for treatment. The recidivism rate is another separate question which I hope that this committee examines carefully. While we have no precise recidivism figures, we're informed that the impressionistic figure is somewhere between 25 and 30% of those people found not guilty by reason of insanity, treated in the state hospital, find themselves back, either in the mental health system or in the criminal justice system. Last year, in the first 6 months of 1982, the Psychiatric Security Review Board found it necessary to rescind the conditional releases of fully 47% of the persons committed to that division, that board. That is nearly half. And finally, even though it is argued that the insanity defense is really another form of insanity sentence, and Mr. Rogers and his co-authors have made a very interesting and strong argument to that effect in the Oregon State Bar Bulletin, which is cited to you in my testimony. Nonetheless, that argument fails to demonstrate that the persons who are committed to the mental health system serve anything like the time of those people who commit the same acts as the persons committed to the mental health system, but instead are found guilty by the criminal justice system. To put it another way, and you can make the comparisons themselves, yourselves, whether or not you're looking at the system of not guilty by reason of insanity before or after the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the figure shows that the average length of stay for someone who otherwise would have been convicted of murder is between 21 and 27 months in the state hospital. For attempted murder, it's between 12 and 14 months. And for the crime of rape, if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, the average length of stay varied between 22 and 24 months in the state hospital. Obviously, figures far less significant and far less lengthy than those of a person who comparably was convicted. I think you're all aware of the options that are available to you. Tinkering with the system and doing nothing are two of them that I hope that you reject outright. It seems to me that the choices really revolve around three different approaches that basically attempt to abolish the insanity defense or limit it so far as is constitutionally possible. That is the objective of the measure which the Department of Justice has submitted to you. We do believe that the proposal developed under the chairmanship of Representative Courtney is a sound effort at reform. In the intervening months, however, we've had an opportunity to study the language of that measure more closely, consult more widely with legal experts, read carefully Supreme Court decisions in the state of Oregon, which have come down since that, and of course, finally, to examine the American Psychiatric Association's Blue Ribbon Panel report issued in December 1982. Let me highlight, although my testimony attempts at considerable length to develop the argument so that it can be illustrated in various ways, but let me highlight, if I can, the three or four major differences between the Department of Justice approach and the approach of House Bill 2075, if I can. First of all, let's make it clear that under all three bills that are before you, if a person's able to appreciate the criminality of his or her act and form a necessary culpable mental state, he or she is going to be found guilty under all three bills. That is not a different. However, if a person is able to form the necessary culpable mental state, that is the end of the inquiry with respect to that kind of defendant as far as the Department of Justice bill is concerned. And if that element, the mental element, the mens rea of the crime is present, then that person who had committed the act and was able to form the intent would be found guilty under the Department of Justice bill. There would be no further reference to the psychiatric security.
He's then agreed to more than four out of five of them. And I'm not sure it's really a fair reason to say it's too expensive. I think most of us who are concerned about the criminal justice system would like to see more money put into the criminal justice system. And here we have a system which seems to be working pretty well and undoubtedly costs somewhat more per capita than the corrections system. But is that good or bad? By the same token, we have statements made about New York State. We have more insanity defenses in New York State. I think that's correct. We also have more clean air, we have more honest politicians. The question isn't do we have more or less of it, the question is it good or bad? And it's those kinds of evaluations that I think need to be made by this committee. And I hope that this material we've submitted, although lengthy, and I realize all of you have much too much to read already, might be of some assistance. It's broken down by kinds of questions that are specific, that are frequently asked about the insanity defense, with, we hope, fairly brief summary answers to them.
I think it would be helpful if you could I'd like you to review the testimony of the Attorney General as presented today. Do you have a written copy of it?
No, I don't. I was going to get a copy.
And I'd like to ask if you could be prepared when we have further hearings, if you could respond rather specific, in a rather specific, focused way to the points the Attorney General has raised.
I'd be glad to
impose on you for that preparation. Representative Lombard?
Well, my question was really was going to get to this, Jeff. I think you raise, you know, the rhetorical question that in part needs to be answered by this committee, and that is, what is it that needs to be fixed? Have you had any continuing dialogue with the district attorneys, with their association or certain district attorneys around the state, to try to determine with or from them what they perceive the problems to be? I almost get the feeling that PSRB is working over here, you folks are working over here making your studies, looking at stats, and they're working over here, and the two of you have been talking with each other.
We've been talking with each other. We don't always agree, even though I'm a prosecutor. I think I've been in contact with them quite a bit, including during the stage they were drafting their bill. I have a hard time knowing exactly what the problem is, except that there's no question that the insanity defense is a frustrating area. There is something vague about it. But there's something very vague about intent, knowledge, recklessness, criminal negligence. There's something vague about mens rea. There's something vague about the whole part of the criminal justice system that says you're guilty not only when you do the thing, but only if you did it with some mental state. Whenever you get into talking about mental states, it starts getting troublesome. But I can't help but think that, in addition, some of the problem is that the insanity defense got a bad reputation and is still suffering from it. And it gets a bad reputation in situations like the Hinckley case. It got a bad reputation in the early 70s here when it was creating some real significant problems. And this state responded to it. I think there's a little bit of a hangover effect. In addition, it is expensive, but I can't believe that the kind of cases we're talking about can be made cheap. Whenever you're talking about mens rea, when you're talking about psychiatric testimony, whether it's on an insanity defense or on the intent issue, it's going to be expensive. Lots of other things in the criminal justice system that are extremely expensive too. I wish it weren't called the defense. I think people might feel a little better. So I can't give you a good answer as to what the problem is, although we have been in touch.
I guess I wonder, you know, setting aside the public perception issue for a moment, because that is a problem for us. I think there's no question, but the public perception is a problem that exists. But on the one hand, I'm sure that, you know, to listen to Dale Penn tell you that, you know, that he feels that it is overused, used excessively, is probably no new charge to you. My question is, well, you know, have you and Dale or other members of the District Attorney's Association actually sat down and said, well, now, what is your basis for saying it's overused? What evidence do you have? And so on. And that's the kind of things that I wonder if they're talking about, you know, things that do have, that can be quantified, if that has been a matter of dialogue.
I personally have not done that in that format that you're talking about. I've met with DA groups as representative of the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I should clarify, by the way, that I am no way speaking on behalf of the U.S. Attorney's Office here. As a representative of that in another capacity, I used to go to the executive committee meetings of the DA's Association. We would discuss the insanity defense there. So I've had a lot of discussions with them, but we have not done what you are asking about, actually sat down and said, where is the common ground, what are the problems, and what can we do about it? Perhaps that's a good idea.
Representative Courtney?
Yes, Jeff. Always so difficult talking to you. What's wrong? You heard me say, and we've talked about this so many times, but that, interesting enough, when we got in the process, we heard from the Psychiatric Security Review Board people, as well as psychiatrists, that the word not responsible, I know it may be cosmetic, was some cases, I don't know how many cases, Joe, creating problems in terms of treating people at Oregon State Hospital. So would you object, or would you say that if that is an area that perhaps we could work on to make better, or you don't buy that, or what? As I say, that didn't come from me, that came from, it was Candice as well as Sukow, that, hey, you know, is that an area where perhaps we can do something? I'm trying to get from you, I know you say, what is the problem? And I could tell that you may feel that, in view of certain things that have been said here today, the system is taking some raps it doesn't deserve. I don't mean that, but the rap in this case came, or at least was supported in part, by people on your side, that is, PSRB people. So what about that, first of all?
I think there's probably something to do that, something to that in a small number of cases. And I no longer care what you label any of this.
Okay.
You know, guilty but a little bit crazy and not real bad or something. Okay.
Now,
what I care about is what happens to them and what that means for the public.
Okay, now we take, and this is also, I'm constantly dealing with perception here. Representative Lombard hit the head, nail right on the head. Let's take the amendments to our bill. You know, the bill as it stands now, 2075, says it wouldn't even let you conditionally release people who've committed certain kinds of real bad crimes. and I'm sure you might take exception to that, but let's say that aside, once the board finds the disease or defect has been cured, whatever that means, they would stay under the jurisdiction of PSRB for the remainder of the sentence and let them use the tools they now have in terms of conditional release, whatever. Would that be something you'd feel would be an improvement upon the system? That's, of course, an amendment 2075, which says, no, they're going over to the correction. Is that an improvement, in your opinion?
Yes, in some senses. To the extent that it would help reassure the public and others. Secondly, to the extent that it would give the review board a handle if that person down the line
right.
started causing problems.
Right. See, one of the things that really stunned me in the Attorney General's testimony, and I'm going to read here, is, and you started a comment, Sukal says that 30 to 40% of the people over there don't belong over there. That stunned me because that goes back, though, to the stipulation. Perhaps that shows the abuse of the system by the defense and the prosecution. That's what Sukal says, supposedly certified smart. Then he goes on to say something that he said in front of me in my committee, which startled me, because I said this in my testimony, and I said I didn't know what he meant by it. After finding of not responsible that are not appropriate for treatment. However, many of these people continue to be a danger to others and for the welfare of society need incarceration. Now, maybe what he's saying is, when he made that kind of statement in front of my committee, I felt he said there was a limbo land of insanity he was talking about. They don't have a disease or defect, but they're dangerous. But we have to discharge them. Therefore, I like this bill 2075. And he said that. At that time, we were putting them over to OSP. Now I would recommend to the committee, if they chose to do this, that you kept at OSH. Is he saying here that you do find yourself at times as a member of that board? I know no longer you're there, but you were the original chair and the head of that board. That you must say technically the disease and defect is gone, but there's enough still of a mental imbalance there. Now, once again, I'm not a psychiatrist, that they really shouldn't be discharged, even though technically they should be by the law.
I'm not sure exactly what Dr. Sukal is referring to. Remember that, as you know, the legislature also changed the definition of mental disease or defect in 1977 to include a situation where the disease is in remission at the time.
Right.
So
right.
So people can seem fine, but still have a mental disease or
right.
defect in remission and be held onto. Now, there are some people, but a very small number, whose mental disease and defect becomes cured, whatever that means.
Right.
That's a very small number, and so I'm not sure which of those two categories he's referring to. It's only when you can say that the disease is gone, it's
right.
no longer there, whether it's not just a matter of it's being in remission, it's just disappeared. And that doesn't happen very much with the major mental illnesses. On page 14 of the paper I referred, the summary paper, it shows the diagnoses provided by the state hospital staff shows that 78% by that category have major mental illness of either psychosis, organic brain syndrome, or mental retardation. And subsequent studies we've done show a little higher than that. 80 to 85% have what, by the Oregon State Hospital diagnoses, have what everybody agrees is a major mental illness. And I think you will find by talking to most psychiatrists, they will say that once you have that kind of a major mental illness, it doesn't disappear. It may go in remission. The controversial area has to do with the 20% that the hospital believes are personality disorders. Those are sort of the ones where they tend to say these are inappropriate to be here. But you need to remember that those were disputed by other psychiatrists early on. And all of our studies show that it's about, there's controversy about 20% of these things, not only about diagnoses, but about contested trials. It's about that same percentage that are contested by the prosecution. And you can say 20% is higher, you can say it's low. Meaning, if you look at, you look at criminal trials about whether the person did the act. Was that the person who did that bank robbery? Or was he in Seaside as an alibi? There's controversy in 20% of those cases. You know, it sounds easy. Did he do it or not? But that's a very difficult question, too. And these are very difficult questions. The fact that there's 80% agreement, not only on diagnosis, but on appropriateness of placing them in the hospital and agreeing to it by the prosecution, I think is remarkable. I don't know of any other part of the criminal justice system where there's that high an agreement on the successful outcomes. Now, I should remind you that ignores the cases where the prosecution contests it and successfully. For instance, the case that the Attorney General referred to where the psychiatrist said he had a bad temper, I'd like to know what the outcome of that case was. I have a guess. There are a lot of pretty flaky alibi defenses. There are a lot of pretty flaky defenses used in every part of the criminal justice system. It's not just in the psychiatric area.
By the way, I stand corrected. It wasn't Sukow, it's Trelevin. So that's not right. It's Dr. Trelevin who made those statements in the hearing. That's all.
Well, we certainly have the obligation as the subcommittee in dealing with this or any issue to satisfy ourselves that we have, pardon the term, a good diagnosis of the problem that's being presented for action. If you don't have that, you're bound to go down the wrong track. So we're going to spend whatever time is necessary to put on our total workload in order to deal carefully with this issue. And we appreciate, Jeff, you certainly have a unique blend of backgrounds here in terms of both your involvement with the academic side of this issue and also as a practicing prosecutor yourself. So and your own experience with the board. So we're pleased that you will be available to work with the subcommittee along with others to help our understanding of this.
Thank you. May I just add one comment to follow up on that to close? One of my concerns also is, as I'm sure the committee is concerned, that nothing is done that leads to inadvertently backfires. For instance, in some of these amendments, I think, could invite constitutional challenges which have not yet been brought. This board, considering the kind of power it has over these individuals, considering how quickly it can revoke them and bring them back to the hospital, has been remarkably free of constitutional challenges. And I think, perhaps I speculate, that that's because defense attorneys as well see that this board plays a useful function in providing supervision and treatment for these individuals. I think there are some defense attorneys here who appear before the board who might agree with that. The fact that there is a high rate of revocations and bringing people back to the hospital is good, not bad. That says the system is working. We'd have a lot fewer people on parole committing new crimes if the parole board had the money to be able to supervise people that closely. And to start doing things which tinkers too greatly with the defense and which makes it even more punitive than it is now, risks inviting constitutional challenges, which could, I think, have backfire and cause some real problems for a system. So I'm hesitant, I will be hesitant to support any change which is too drastic in a system which I have a hard time seeing what the big problems are. There are lots of little problems, but I have a hard time seeing the big problems.
Further questions? Jeff, again, I would appreciate your reviewing the testimony of the Attorney General, and at your next appearance, I'm going to want to kind of have you relate responses specifically to those points.
Do that. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be adjourned as a subcommittee until I guess it's next week. So two, I think, is meeting tomorrow. Okay?
No.
We are.
We meet
one tomorrow.
Yeah.
Subcommittee one meets tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Two is Friday.
Yeah, that's what we switched. You were adjourned at 1:30 tomorrow.